I don't want a pickle. I just want to ride on my motorcycle.
Hey there, guys and gals. We're rolling now with episode 36 of the Noco Moto podcast. And we just enjoyed another one of our 300 days of sunshine we get every year here in northern Colorado. It was a little bit chillier, even a little bit chillier than normal for this time of year, but it was still sunny as fuck. I think it's the earliest I've gotten an F-bomb into an episode. Right. So I'm your host, MotoGP, and with me always is Swiggy.
Yo.
Yo. And we've got some listener emails to get to right at the top of the show. A little housekeeping here. So we've got an email from Dan. And we've gotten an email from Dan before. He emailed us a while back talking about having his V-Star 650 and making a whole bunch of like road trips to like go ride with his dad and his brother and all sorts of awesome shit. And he had this GS 1100 with all sorts of crazy work done to it. So he sent us a little of an update because he was asking some advice on what kind of bike to go with and whatever. And I believe we had a lot of different suggestions, but ultimately told him going with a KLR was a pretty good bet. So it turns out he bought the KLR and he sold the 650. And he got $1,200 for the 650. I don't remember the do you remember the mileage or anything he said he had on that bike?
No.
He sent us pictures, but, you know, whatever. Someone got a V-Star 650 for $1,200, and you can't complain about that, right? And so he got an 05 KLR 650, he says, with 12,000 miles. I do want to say before that, he writes that he was super stoked that we read his email before, played it for his dad and his brother and anyone else in Alabama who would listen, and everyone thought it was super cool. And you know what? That was double fucking super cool because an unusual amount of listens we've noticed popped up from that area of the state. So you know what? We noticed, buddy. Thank you for spreading the show around. Now, he bought this KLR, and he says it's been all kitted out by the previous owner, but the motor was stock aside from the doohickey mod. That's important. If you're going to buy a KLR, it's got to have the doohickey mod. Anyway.
For my own edification, what is the doohickey mod?
So the doohickey mod, I'm not like super, super up on this, but basically there's some sort of problem with the original design on the KLR with the timing chain or the cam chain or whatever. And there's this piece that was made out of two different pieces welded together. It would fail a lot or whatever. And it's something with the slack on the chain. It'll cause just havoc if it breaks, and it's bad news bears. And it was really the only problem anyone ever found with the design of this machine. So it was just common just to take this thing apart, have this piece replaced with an aftermarket piece, which all of us, you know, loads of people put their hands up and made replacement pieces for this bike. So if you buy, I think around like 2008 or something, they fixed this problem in the bike. I might not be completely correct on the year on that. But if you're buying an early KLR 650, you have to make sure the doohickey mod has been done. It's not expensive. It's not super difficult. But if it's been done, then the bike's totally mechanically sound, basically. The machine's bulletproof except for this little fucking thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
So he got that done. And then the bike, he said here, has a whole bunch of mods. So he's got a bigger brake rotor, steel braided lines, the bark busters, fork brace, progressive springs, Renthal handlebars, some sort of aftermarket fairing, 12-volt outlet for charging shit. He's got a 6.6-gallon tank on it, nice. Center stand, skid plate, off-road pegs, sergeant seat, Lex full exhaust, 50-50 tires, whatever. It's a KLR. They all have 50-50 tires. And a bunch of little guards all over for when the bike gets dumped. Okay, so he's got a bunch of things for if he drops it. All right, cool.
Now, those 50-50 tires, They're pretty sweet. The only problem is they wear out insanely quickly.
Yeah, they do.
If you're having issues with those, I would recommend going to something like the 80-20 tires, 80 street, 20 dirt. Those are generally going to last you quite a bit longer. And that's generally what you see on a lot of adventure bikes when they want to go for the adventure look, but want to be reasonably practical for the 98% of street use they're actually going to see.
Right. Now, there's a lot more to this email. I don't know how I'm going to read every word because it's a little bit lengthy, but there are some really great things in here. So this kind of coincidentally ties into something that Cleveland Moto was talking about recently. And although he didn't buy this from a dealership, he talks about how he went in sort of looking for, you know, what he wanted and basically showing up with the money that he knew it was worth and, you know, doing nothing but intending to like find the bike he wanted to buy and then just buy that fucking bike rather than fuck around with a bunch of shit. He sort of looked for, you know, the bike that he wanted with the stuff he wanted on it or whatever. He found the bike he wanted and then just went and bought it, rather than trying to haggle over price on a bunch of bikes that were compromised or weren't exactly what he was looking for. So that's really cool. But also, he did a he watched Fort Nine's video on buying used bikes and went through all that sort of stuff. You know, smart. Suggested maybe we could do something about talking about how to buy used bikes, but, you know, that's such a crazy subject.
Honestly, if you've watched the Fort Nine video, I don't know if I have much to add to that that isn't just straight up marketplace haggling.
Well, the thing is, there's so many different bikes that have so many different potential problems or things to look out for. I mean,
we should do how to buy a shitty bike off Craigslist.
Yeah, yeah, I would be much better to do. Yeah, I think, okay, there you go. All right, Dan, that's the video we're going to do. How to buy just a shitbox project video. God damn it. All right, sorry. We're going to do, yeah, I think we should do that.
How do you buy a piece of shit off Craigslist for the right price?
Exactly. That's something we can do. All right. So anyway, he talks about some other stuff, getting the bike home and some things he had to do to fix the fan because that wasn't working, but it was something he was able to haggle price on. And basically, everything turned out great. Is basically, you know, the what's going on here. He still has his GS1100, which is running great. Though he said it started making some sort of awful noise during a 150-mile ride. And then, I don't know, some sort of bracket, the horn, I don't know, on the valve cover. It turned out to be nothing. So basically, shit's running awesome for Dan. And he got his KLR, he got rid of the Suzuki, but most importantly, at the end here, he says he's attached some pictures of the KLR Suzuki and then his roommate's $850 Honda Hornet masterpiece. And he says he's hoping that his roommate will email us. Well, then, not too long afterwards, we received this email and from Tyler, Dan's roommate. And this is short and sweet. So it says, "Hey guys, new listener and beginner writer here. Figured I'd write you guys and let you know that I'm really enjoying your podcast and that I hope you continue to create the great content. Thank you. Anyway, since I'm a new writer, I guess I'll tell you how I got started since you guys are kind of involved. I got into motorcycles through my roommate, Dan, who is a listener of yours. I started riding on his V-Star and it was great to learn on. A few months ago, I started toying with the idea of getting a bike of my own. Dan introduced me to the best worst bike of the week, and we started hunting for a Ninja 250. Awesome. During the process of searching for the Ninja, I came across this Honda 599. It was not running, but it did turn over when Dan and I inspected it, so I decided to take a chance and buy it. I figured it would be a long process getting it running, but as it turned out, two of the four main jets in the carbs were completely blocked after a clean and emptying out two bottles of seafoam mixed with about a half gallon of gas the previous owner had in the tank. She started up and has been on the road ever since. I'm working on some minor maintenance stuff, but I'd say it's 95% there. Anyway, this is all probably more than you need to know, but Dan said y'all might be interested in hearing the story. Thanks for the entertainment and inspiration. All right. And then he goes, P.S. I've added some pictures of the bike. Did mention this earlier, but it's an 04 Honda 599 with the CPR 600RR subframe and center exhaust. So I am tickled pink by this. This is fucking awesome. So there's a story here, which is Dan is sort of becoming what I call a motorcycle son, right? He's just infecting people around him to start riding, right? Obviously, you know, he and his dad and his brother, there's something that was already going on there, but now he's like, within the Huntsville area, right? He's like patient zero. You know, he's the head vampire, right? Spreading this enthusiasm all over the place, right? It's starting with his roommate here. But like I said, we've seen quite a few listens pop up from this area. So he is getting other people to listen to the show and getting them into bikes. And that is so freaking awesome. And, you know, Dan's a fucking hero because, like, yeah, he and Tyler got here and got this $850 bike that was non-running or whatever, which might be a couple bucks more than I would personally spend on a non-running bike, but it doesn't matter because the story turns out great because they just did a carb clean and now this new rider has a super cheap new bike, right? Well, not new bike, but, you know, pretty good bike. You know, he sent his pictures and it doesn't look bad. It looks pretty clean.
And I believe that bike makes something like 97, 98 horsepower at the crank.
Yeah, it's good. It's good. It's essentially like a 650 class bike, but with a little bit more power. It's right in between a 650 and 600 in terms of what it does. It's right in between there. It's a good bike.
Yeah, it's not quite the F4i, you know, super sport horsepower with a comfy frame, but it is... It's more than your usual 650 detuned motor numbers.
Yeah. Well, here you go, Tyler. If you want to, like, you know, something to hang your hat on, I believe it's this exact bike that Phil from Cleveland Moto has been saying he's been wanting for like a month now. He's just sort of in the market looking for a good one of these. You know, like this is a sort of diamond in the rough, like do everything kind of bike. It's a cool bike. I mean, is it exceptional in any specific way? No, but as a first bike, this is badass. I mean, my first bike was a Nighthawk 650, which was good, but this is even better. And, you know, it's kind of fitting because this is what the Nighthawk line sort of turned into, the Hornets. It fills the same space in Honda's lineup.
Mm-hmm.
The difference is yours is from 2004 and mine was from 1984. So you're going to have a much better time on this than I did on mine. The story here is that we've got someone sort of infecting everyone else. And then we've got this awesome story of these guys new to motorcycles, sort of. Well, one of them brand new to motorcycles anyway. And just getting a bike, saving it from the crusher, doing a carb clean, getting on the road real cheap. And then, you know, these pictures of like, you know, the bikes lined up on the back porch of their house or apartment here, whatever, like you can just feel this little club, this little cult growing here. You know, before you know it, these guys are just going to have like eight other motorcycle friends and they're going to be a force to be reckoned with. And this is what it's all about. You know, we read every email and respond to most of them. And, you know, it sounds like a mundane story until you sort of like pick it apart. And what's going on here is exactly what everyone needs. Not just this whole rebel without a cause thing, this getting into motorcycles and getting other people into it. And then, you know, just building in a community into it, even in your own small little area, your own little group of friends, and just starting to do the thing, You know, all this stuff that people used to get, used to have to be in like a motorcycle club to be in. Now it's much more different, you know, with forums and these podcasts and, you know, people sending us emails and these guys just doing their little thing on their own.
And eBay,
right? It's all just blown wide open. And this is what we love to talk about. So badass, both of you guys. Who knows? Like one day, I'm sure, you know, we'll be riding across country and we'll get to meet you or something. But in the meantime, like, keep doing exactly what you're doing, because this is what it's all about. Buying shitbox or nearly shitbox bikes, fixing them up, turning them around, buying and selling, riding different stuff, getting your friends into it. This is the very essence of what these days I would classify as badass biker shit. So there we go. And I think that's going to do it for emails for right now. And then I think it's time to move to what everyone's waiting for. Best worst bike in the world this week.
Let's go.
All right, let's do it. So this week, you're doing worst bike.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So if it's your first time listening, every week we each choose a bike, alternating best and worst bike in the world this week. We do not know what the other has chosen. Now, you may not agree entirely with what we've chosen, but you know what? Like, why are you getting mad with people who are wrong on the internet anyway? Sort your life out. And as Liza's immortal words go, there's no crying in motorcycles, so we don't want to hear any of it. Now, with that said, it's just a fun way to look at two different bikes that you might not necessarily look at twice. So here we go. Swiggy's got worst bike in the world this week, and now we're going to reveal it. And the worst bike in the world this week is
the Suzuki Katana 2.
Oh my God. You know, we haven't done this as a worst bike in the world, but I've complained about this bike on this show in probably 7 different episodes. I hate this thing. I hate it so much. And, you know, I hate it because it was so close to being good.
And well, it was so close, but so far at the same time.
Right. Yeah.
Now, something I didn't realize was just how cheap this bike actually was.
Oh, yeah. This was your bang for this. To this day, the GSXR, even though this isn't a Gixxer, to this day, the GSXR, it's just assumed and has the reputation for being the best bang for buck horsepower on the road, or the 600 anyway. But these days, the GSXR 600 really isn't any cheaper than the equivalent 600s. And if it is, by like what, $150, like it's nothing. But this really was. The GSXR
600 and 750 today, I believe, are more expensive than a CBR.
Really? Yeah, it doesn't surprise me. I mean, with the amount of updates those get. But back in the day, it's
kind of migrated towards that precision, no frills, super
dedicated track bike with turn signals. Exactly.
Yeah. You still get dual analog gauges on the Gixxer 750.
It's less complexity. It's a race bike.
What do you need it for? Yeah. So I've been going over this bike a little bit, and I found a little bit of a mystery here.
Okay.
Okay, so how much horsepower do you think this, and this is in,
wheel or the crank?
At the crank, we're going to pick the 99 model.
I think this makes 96 or 98 horsepower at the crank.
This bike makes 86 horsepower.
At the crank?
Yep.
Jesus. I thought it was at least close to 100.
Now, here's where it gets really weird.
And everything else in this class was making over 100 at this time.
This motor is under square, this motor is very much over square, 62.6 by 48.7.
Yeah.
So significantly over square. It's got an 11 0.3 to 1 compression ratio.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you think it revs to make that power?
Well, considering those numbers, I mean, with that short stroke and that big bore, it should be able to just rev to infinity. But I think what I recall is that the problem with this bike is that the cooling system wasn't very good, so it could only rev to like 10,000 RPM or 10.5.
I would be much more forgiving on this bike if it only revved to 9.5 to 10,000 RPM. With the 86 horsepower, that would all make sense, especially with the 11.3 to 1 compression.
Right.
But it revs to 11,000, and it's still making only 86 horsepower with that compression ratio.
Yeah, so that just tells you this engine was fucked up. There was like terrible thermal efficiency. They threw this engine together, and it was just not figured out. Like it's sort of unforgivable for it to be this bad at this time when all the competition was well over 100 horsepower at the crank all over the place.
Now, given that the CB900 and the CB1000 were both air-cooled inline fours and, you know, 60% large displacement, and that they both took 4 quarts of oil,
yeah.
How much oil do you think this motor took as a 600?
I would still go with 4 quarts.
This motor takes 5 quarts of oil.
Again, this is back to my thing. I think the cooling system was fucked up on this bike.
What cooling system? It was air-cooled.
Wait, it was air-cooled?
Yes.
Are you okay, that's why. Yeah, because everything else at this time was liquid-cooled. Okay.
But even then, a CB900 is 86 horsepower as well in a 1-liter motor. What's going on in this motor? Well, let's say 17 years later.
Right.
Okay. That it doesn't work. This is what I'm trying to piece together, because this bike is making large amounts of energy just disappear and breaking the laws of thermodynamics.
Right. Yeah. How can it?
With these numbers, how does it make so little power?
Yeah, I don't know. Well, I mean, that is still a low rev range, like for this bike, because, you know, take my 93 ZX6E, right? That went to 14,500 RPM, right? And that made it make, you know, 100 something horsepower with the crank or whatever, maybe 101 horsepower, and, you know, put 90 to the back wheel, something like that, and it was liquid cooled and all that sort of stuff. But that was a motor that was, you know, Kawasaki was so ahead of the game in all of this. You know, this is like a motor that would have been really impressive for a sport bike in 1989, not 1999.
Right.
Especially not being liquid cooled, still being an air cooled sport bike like this. This thing's living in the past, but the problem for me is that this bike was sort of touted as an equivalent to the competition. And the styling. We have to talk about the styling. We've talked about it before on the show.
This bike, to me, in profile, it kind of looks like...
It looks like you gave a ninja bad Botox. Am I off base? Like, it's bulbous and round, and if you look at any individual part of it, you'd be like, oh, that's kind of cool. If you just look at the tail section, you'd be like, oh, it's very rounded and sculpted and cool. And if you look at, like, the gaps where you would expect there to be radiators behind or whatever in the side panels, you'd be like, oh, okay, it's like this big flowing form. And if you look at the front headlights, you'd be like, oh, I would expect like BMW to do something like this with a sport bike, with these two headlights, but they're in the same piece, but they've I don't know, every individual part of it you can't complain about. Even like the belly pan that comes up really high and gives the bike this two-tone color, like you'd be like, oh, that's different. Like I can kind of see why they did that and why they're going with it. But the whole thing together is just like, you know, just LA trophy wife, 15 years past her prime, way too much surgery, way too much Botox, and none of it makes sense anymore.
The coke has taken its toll.
The coke has taken its toll. That's right. Yeah, and that does make sense too, because if you think about it, you know, this bike sort of is derived from the original GSX 750, a legendary track bike. You know, that's the rock star. This bike is like, you know, the child movie star of the GSX 750 rock star that got a little bit of attention early on and then just fizzled out and spiraled out of control into disaster by its late teens. No, thank you. There's nothing redeeming about this. You cannot imagine. Oh, it's terrible.
But and it's even just like the vents for the oil cooler just along the side, because this is still an air cooled motor. Like,
right,
there's no liquid cooling here. And but
why the fuck is it?
Oh. Like the split vent, which kind of makes it just look like it's been gored a couple times by a bull.
Yeah, it looks almost accidental. It's not right. For
some reason, this styling carried over to the Hayabusa.
Well, hold on. I've talked about this before as well. In the Hayabusa, it makes sense because the Hayabusa was so over the top. You could go with some sort of ridiculous sort of off styling, and much like the GS1200, people who have Hayabusas are sort of like proud of how ugly the bike is, right? It when you get into that category of bike, it's more important to be distinct or distinguished rather than beautiful or handsome.
Yeah.
But this bike, you know, if this bike did, you know, was 118 horsepower, right? Not even anything that mind blowing, but 118 would have been really impressive for the time. I would find ways to try to like this, because I'd go like, oh my gosh, this bike is so weird looking, but.
As you've tried so hard with the Z900 styling.
I tried hard with the Z900 styling. I still admit it's good. It's just not my thing. This is nobody's thing. Unless you go by a weird nickname, like, not Bubba, but like, you know, people call you like, you know, T-Hatch or T-something, like a letter dash something, and none of your close friends know your actual name, and you live in a trailer park, and, you know, you've got a little bit of history with the law. You don't know every cop in town by first name, but a few of them know you, you know, on a name basis. Like, then this styling really appeals to you. But outside of that, it's a no-go. Everyone universally agrees this is terrible. This is what we don't like from the 90s. This is...
Well, hats off to them for just trying something different, but...
But they didn't try anything different, because essentially what this is Suzuki ripping off the kind of technology that was in the GPZ 900 a decade or more than a decade earlier, and just going, hey, we'll put it in a 600 package, and that's still kind of viable. We'll throw a bunch of plastic all over it, and people will think it's a modern sport bike. But really,
everything copied the GPZ 900.
Yeah, but this was still copying it underneath the skin, almost note for note.
Yeah.
Okay, is this even a twin spar frame?
No, it's a tubular frame.
See, like, this is not really a sport bike. This is some sort of, like, mid-80s sport cruiser sort of thing with just plastic thrown over it to make it look really 90s sporty.
Now, here's something that I cannot stop thinking about every time I look at this bike now. Because something that this bike does that I haven't seen out of any other bike is the joined headlights
right
in the middle. And all I can think of every time I look at this bike now is Sonic the Hedgehog.
Holy shit, you're right. It has Sonic the Hedgehog's eyes. I was going to say it has... There was a certain fashion of ski goggles that were popular around the time that are a similar shape as well. You know, because everything like, you know, shortly after this went for this, the big like mono goggle, right? Do you remember that weird phase of skiing where there were no eye separations? But like right before that, like late 90s, you got ski goggles that looked exactly like this. It was around the time, too, that people used to just walk around in public with ski goggles just stuck to the top of their head, like in the middle of the summer.
Yeah.
They would be frequently wearing wetsuits as well. Like, the 90s was a weird time. Yeah, this fits into that, though. But this bike is so 90s that Vanilla Ice didn't even go for it. He stuck with the 80s GPZ 750, you know?
No, he had the R6, didn't he?
No. Vanilla Ice was GPC, GSX.
He had the Gixxer 750.
Yeah, like the original one,
the first gen. Yeah,
but Vanilla Ice would have never been caught dead on a katana. That's how horrible this is. So. Yeah, I don't know if I can damn this bike anymore, that stylistically, even Vanilla Ice would have never touched this.
Well, the other thing is that even though I don't like...
Speaking of which, do you think we could get Vanilla Ice on this show?
At this point, it's a distinct possibility. He's
a big bike enthusiast. Write into us if you really want us to try to get Vanilla Ice. I would talk to Vanilla Ice for hours about bikes, but anyway.
There was one thing I was looking for.
Maybe he'll be at AIM.
All right. What was I looking for? There's one other thing on this bike. Oh, yeah. So also, this was a bike with... now, we can't really shit on it too much for this, because as we've brought up many a time, inverted forks are pretty much overkill.
Yeah.
For the vast majority of people. So it did have conventional telescopic forks, which I'm actually going to put as a plus in its favor, given how cheap it was. And this is a feature that would have actually have dropped the price quite a bit.
Yeah.
But what I will hold against it is the fact that this bike was so bad that it killed off the entire katana name.
Right.
Which is possibly one of the coolest Japanese motorcycle names besides Ninja.
Okay, we do need to talk about that. When I was in like fourth grade or some shit, right, there were only three names for motorcycles: Harley, Ninja, and Katana. Now, Katana was definitely the lesser known of the three names, but everyone at my elementary school referred to motorcycles by only those three terms. These were super cheap, and people did buy them by the truckload just because they were cheap. And the original Katana, we've discussed, you hate it, I love it. It's one of those bikes that divides people, which kind of lets you know it's a very important bike, right? You love it or hate the original Katana, you cannot deny its importance. And it's sort of, you know, the Katana's after that sort of just became just increasingly awful, ultimately ending up with this. And I mean, the Katana before this one is even like weirder looking, but somehow isn't as offensive. I don't know. But as you said, this killed off the whole thing. This is where it stopped. I mean, and they made them into like 2004, I think, or something like that.
Almost up to like 2006.
Oh yeah. That
it,
long?
It hung on for a long time. But then they just said, this bike was doing so poorly that they just said, fuck it. We're just going to now create the GSX-S.
Right.
And merge this into the GSX name and the GSXR bodywork.
Because the name is so, the katana name has been so tarnished.
Right. And the GS, the Gixxer name is doing so well that we're just going to merge it in to save our budget bike brand.
Well, and it's taken what? So since 2006, then, so it's taken 12, 13 years for that tarnish to start to wear off. It's been over a decade of
and they're
Suzuki
not picking
just
up
trying
where they
to
left
let
off.
No, they're going right back to the beginning with the old katana. Because fuck any of this nonsense. Like, this is so white trash, like, associated that no one would. If you're, you know, because everyone wants to be a somewhat like lifestyle brand now, right? And in America, riding motorcycles is still predominantly a lifestyle sort of thing rather than a practical thing, right? So you would never, unless Suzuki was doing like a really bizarre trailer park chic sort of move with their marketing, they would never try to return to something that wasn't immediately just reminiscent of the original katana rather than this one, because this is just terrible.
Let's put it this way. If you own a katana at this point in North America, there's a good chance that cinder blocks feature heavily in your day-to-day life and property management.
Right. There is a good chance that you own six tarps, all of which are currently in use. It's not a good look. It's just not a good look. And I love weird bikes, and I love bikes that are largely unloved by people. I like ugly ducklings. That's just who I am. I like to go against the grain a lot. I agree with everyone else in the world on this one. I can't go there. Yeah. Anything else to say about it?
I think I've made my case.
I will add, too, that there was a GSX 750F katana this entire time as well, but equally unimpressive. But the 600 really does highlight the bad parts of what's going on with this motorcycle. So, all right, worst bike in the world, GSXF 600, GSX, Jesus.
It's such an awful name. It's got to have the R in the end. It just doesn't flow.
You know what? The 98 Katana, worst bike in the world this week. Okay, so now, you know, real quick before I say this, I just had a thought. If we could get Vanilla Ice on the show, the episode I want to do is I want to do a commentary track for Cool as Ice with Vanilla Ice. I mean, there's like, what, a 1 in 100 chance we might meet him at AIM? Like, okay, here we go. All right, and now, the best bike in the world this week is... the 2006, or any year, they didn't make them for very many years, Kawasaki Vulcan 2000. So, there's this thing going on right now where a lot of millennials and sort of sub-millennials, even Generation Z, whatever people, sort of that like 25 to 35-year-old age bracket wants to buy an old used Harley and sort of own it ironically, right? They want to have this big bagger cruiser thing or whatever and kind of have this Gen X object, but own it very cheaply and weirdly and ironically. Forget it. This is the bike you want. This is the ultimate Gen X bike. And it is the, sorry, not Gen X, baby boomer bike. Sorry. These millennials don't want to own a Gen X bike. They want to own a baby boomer bike. Sorry. This is the ultimate baby boomer bike. and it's fantastic. Okay. So as opposed to a lot of other things that were being made around this time, right? So last episode I was talking about the Honda Rune coming out in like 2006 and being this big statement, this big excess thing to own, right? And the economy was going so well that people would just drop stupid money on a gigantic motorcycle that was just over proportioned and just insane and didn't really make any sense.
Mm-hmm.
This one actually makes sense.
It is very, very Road King.
It's very Road King. So I want to talk about the styling a little bit first, right?
Well, I guess it is a bit more of kind of the generic Softail styling.
A little bit. So most of it looks very normal, sort of Vulcan 1500, Vulcan 1600 in the styling. It's got the same sort of very similar tank, the logo, the fenders, the two-tone paint scheme that's the same on all of them, except this one has like huge stock, gigantic in-your-face pipes. Rather than like the one pipe coming off each side, they both swoop off to one side a little bit more Harley-esque.
Yeah, the other ones went for more of the silencer style.
These are big in-your-face exhausts. This one has a gigantic, very throwback, huge nacelle over the headlight, giving it a super classic look. Gigantic handlebars, a lot of other very Vulcan things that you would expect. And otherwise, it's not super remarkable, except that it is obviously from the 2000s, but definitely has a big classic throwback look to it. And it's very simple and clean, more importantly. There's not a lot of bells or whistles or anything. It's just a very clean, big, chromey cruiser. And, you know, it pulls off the Vulcan look better than any other of the Vulcans, I think. Right? So why is this bike so good? Well, it's in the name, the Vulcan 2000. But here's where it diverges from the rest of the Vulcan family very sharply. Everything else that has the Vulcan badge makes around 60-something horsepower and just varying levels of torque and whatever, right? They all sort of figured out, well, you know, these Harleys make, you know, 60-something horsepower, whatever. You know, the CB750 made 60-something. That's kind of what you need. We'll make a bunch of bikes that all sort of satisfy that in very different styles and sizes of cruiser. But, you know, with the engines, they'll all make the power a slightly different way, all to achieve that goal. That went out the window with this bike. So it's 2,053 cc's. That's 125.27 cubic inches. That's gigantic. The only other engine in this category that I'm aware of that's larger is the Triumph Rocket 3's motor at 2,300 cc's, right? But this is a fucking gigantic engine at, you know, 2 liters, essentially. Okay. Now, your average Harley is making about a foot pound of torque per square inch, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, they're all kind of hovering just above or just under 100 foot pounds of torque generally. You know, I mean, it varies a lot, but generally that's what they're doing. What do you think this makes in torque?
Well, that big of a V-twin, I can't imagine this thing goes past 5,000 RPM for peak torque. So I'm going to say 125.
141 foot-pounds of torque.
Whoa.
At only 3,000 RPM.
Okay.
This thing is a monster. Like, okay, and then here's where it gets even crazier, right? So traditionally, in a V-twin engine, you would have it be over square, so it has a short stroke and a large bore. Not on this one. Bore is 4.1 and stroke is 4.9. I have that backwards. You would normally have a long stroke and shorter bore, but your ratio of bore to stroke would be, you know, much more elongated than this one is. This is a, for the bore, a shorter stroke as compared to those proportions to a Harley engine. That's what I'm trying to say. Okay, I said that all wrong. Let me just start that again.
So it's closer to square than a Harley motor.
Right. Sorry, what is it? This is where it departs again. While it is still under square, it is a much shorter stroke than you would expect to get that kind of torque. And then what kind of horsepower do you think this makes?
Well, if it's larger and it's more and it's closer to square, and if it's making its torque at 3,000 RPM, it's going to be making its peak horsepower around 4,500.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to guess it's probably a lot higher than your average 65. So I'm going to say 78.
102.
What?
Yes.
What is this rev to?
I'm not sure what the red line is. I couldn't even find it. It's ridiculous. But it makes, at the crank, like 100 and something horsepower. It's ridiculous. With 141 foot-pounds of torque, this bike hauls fucking ass.
Holy
everywhere.
Shit.
This bike will ascend up to, like, you know, 140-something miles an hour. This bike will hold its own with 600 sport bikes. Yeah.
Well, I guess if it's got three times the torque.
Yeah. more than three times the torque, right? And the weight. Oh, God. This is why I hate bikes.com. I can't find the weight all of a sudden. Okay, here we go. So it is a bit heavy at 750 pounds.
I would imagine. Wait, it's only 750?
Exactly. That is heavy, but that is much lighter than the equivalent.
It's like 200 pounds lighter than a
Ultra Classic or whatever.
Than the Star Adventure.
Exactly. 200, yeah. And it's, you know, a full like 70 or 80 pounds lighter than the Honda Rune. Exactly. So it is a big, heavy bike. But again, it's not afraid to be heavy because it is a great big classically styled heavy cruiser. But rather than just only have the torque, it has the horsepower as well. And even more torque than you would ever need for anything, right? You crack the throttle and this thing just blasts away, right?
Well, it is a Kawasaki.
Right.
So large cylinder motors are kind of their jam. So I guess they weren't afraid to run a 1 liter cylinder above 9-to-1 compression.
This is only 9.5. Yeah.
It's only 9. Oh, it's not. This thing must rev pretty high then.
I think it goes like 5.5 or something like that, maybe even 6,000, but it's not.
Which is good for that size of a motor.
Exactly. Now, this is where it really, really just fucking destroys. Because again, everyone in 2006 was doing some sort of gigantic, over-the-top, completely excessive cruiser. And they went for stupid money. This thing came in an MSRP in 2006 of $13,500. Stupid low. Stupid cheap. For what this bike is and
well, that's
what
like
you're getting.
$2,000 to $3,000 less than an Ultra Classic.
At that time, I bet an Ultra Classic was still like $17,000-$18,000 in 2006.
You think so?
You can't get an Ultra Classic for under 21 now.
Yeah, I guess that makes sense.
Right. So it's cheap on the wallet, it's huge on the power. It's great on the styling. So what does this equate to? If you're going to buy one of these things now, you're looking at anywhere from like $4,000 to $6,000 for 141 foot-pounds of torque, 100 horsepower, a big baby boomer cruiser that you can own ironically and still haul ass. Because if you're looking at a 2006, you know, Harley something, Road King, whatever, I'm going to own it ironically, you know, you know, Hallmark of yesteryear, you're going to spend more money than that probably for one that's in good shape, and you're not going to have much performance. But with this thing, you get to live out your millennial, I kind of wish I was born as a baby boomer dream, and haul ass everywhere. Just destroy everybody. This thing is a sleeper because, you know, all these Harley engines, I mean, you know, the 2-liter engine doesn't really look that much larger than, you know, a Harley 88 cubic inch, you know, twin cam or whatever, right? It's just a V-twin on a Japanese bike. And okay, to, again, non-motorcycle people, they're just going to think it's some sort of crazy custom Harley sort of thing. But you're going to roll up and you're going to have this bike, and they are not going to expect you to pull off as quickly as you will. I mean,
2007 on Craigslist.
For how much?
With under 10,000 miles, $6,500.
See? Why, if you were going for a, quote, you know, classic cruiser, why would you go with anything else? This has the displacement. This has the respect. This has, you know, all the guts, all the chrome, everything. And it's not like the Harley name in big cruisers is as cool as it used to be, right?
Right.
So who cares that it's Japanese? It doesn't matter anymore. The fact that it's Japanese might even be a plus, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because you're some guy just buying this sort of like throwback idea. And, you know, no one really cares how, you know, bad to the bone you are on it. Because, I mean, you know, the kind of person that would buy this bike today, it doesn't matter. That's not an important thing to them.
Right.
But you can still cosplay that should you choose to, right? You can still have, like, the zip-up leather with the fold-over button spots on it and everything. And, you know, wear the right sunglasses and your wind in the hair and look that part completely naturally on this bike. You can, and again, you're fast. You can ride with all your sport bike friends. There, I can't think of a way that this bike is not relevant today. Like, I could own one of these. If I was going to have a big cruiser, this is the one for me. Forget anything with a badge and shield on it. Forget the Honda Rune. Forget a Valkyrie. This is the one. Because it's just so freaking powerful. I mean, you know, the VMAX is going to have a higher top speed, but I mean, it's still pretty close.
Well, yeah, it's kind of like with Dad's old Nomad. It was, well, it takes a little bit to get going, but you can sit in second gear up to 75 miles an hour because it's just got so much torque.
Well, and the gears were all so tall. Yeah, it just didn't care.
Yeah, you could break the shifter off in second gear, and the bike is still functional.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
You can go on the highway with it. But with that extra bit of power and at most another 100 pounds,
right,
with almost twice the horsepower and probably another 30 or 40 foot-pounds of torque.
I want to say the Vulcan 1600 comes in just a hair over 700 pounds. So this is only another 40-something pounds heavier, which I'm sure is extra weight from the engine and a little bit longer wheelbase and some things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But overall, I mean, and look, and you know, and the bike's going to stop. It's got, you know, dual front discs and all that sort of nonsense and a pretty good rear brake disc. It's got, you know, it's fuel injected. It's every bit of modern cruiser that you could possibly want, right?
Mm-hmm.
And here's the crazy thing, too. I believe, I gotta look this up here, but I think this is still just a, again, this is why I hate bikes.com. Is this a 2 or 4 valve motor? Yeah.
No, this is a 4 valve.
Oh, there we go. Yeah, right. So yeah, again,
didn't even need to be a 4 valve motor.
Well, here's the thing. If you're looking at buying something with a Milwaukee 8, right? Because they're up to like, you know, 1800 cc's now, like 114 cubic inch, whatever.
This well, I is, really shouldn't be saying that since I was shitting on the Shadow for being a three valve.
Right. But. Here's the thing. Like, if you're looking at buying something with like a new Milwaukee 814 in it or whatever, that motor already existed. Kawasaki made something like the Milwaukee 8, but better in 2006, right? So
there's two other things I've noticed here,
okay,
which perplex me a little. So this is the 2006. And this is carbureted. Did they ever release a fuel-injected version of this?
I don't know if that's correct. I thought they were all fuel-injected. But they stopped making this in, I want to say...
This is DFI as well. So maybe this bike is just so obscure to the general public that all the stats are wrong.
That's what I'm thinking. I believe this is fuel injected because by this time, all the Vulcans were fuel injected. I mean, it's 2006 in Kawasaki. It's not.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, I mean, the Nomad was fuel injected, so it must be.
Yeah. Yeah. This was fuel injected. I'm
now they
I'm
did have sure. some weird carburetor mechanics on it where they had all sorts of adjusters that you could mess with. It wasn't like this wasn't modern fuel injection.
Yeah, it's throttle body injection. It's not direct or anything like that, for sure. And, you know, they're big throttle bodies, 46 mil. Look at that.
And were all of the Vulcans built drive?
No. Again, that's where this one is different and why it gets so much power. Every other is shaft drive. But to make this one as badass as they wanted it to be, they went to belt drive. Because if you've got, you know, a decent amount of horsepower and big torque, belt's your best option.
Right.
So that's another way that this diverges from the rest of the Vulcan line. So while in styling and aesthetic, it is still very, you know, Vulcan 1500, this one departs with the way that the engine is, you know, put together and with the drive system. And it just does a couple little things that turns it into a completely different animal. So again, with that belt drive, it's not like you're making 141 foot-pounds of torque and, you know, like 90s making it to the back wheel. You're still probably getting like 120 foot-pounds of torque to the back wheel, which is just monster numbers. Just monster.
Well, especially when you consider that the Nomad that
my car doesn't put 121 foot pounds of torque to the wheels, right? Like, it's just ridiculous. Well,
that's not a shocker.
That's not a shocker. Okay, right.
But if you take this and compare this to the Nomad, you know, the 1600 Nomad, which is making around 65 horsepower, and you take the 25-ish or more percent off that, then you're getting around, you know, 47 horsepower to the rear wheel, whereas this you're going to take about 17-18% off. So yeah, you're making just shy of double the horsepower on this over the Nomad 1600.
Right. It's ridiculous. It's just ridiculous. And again, the great thing too is that, you know, you're buying this big cruiser, but you're getting all that Kawasaki reliability. You know, it's the same radiator and cooling system that was on the other ones. Like, you know, it works. They've made it for years. It's all been sorted out and the look is really clean. You know, like the only wires that are exposed, there's you can see the speedo drive coming up. And then there's the clutch and throttle cables exposed, and everything else is just hidden away, cleaned up, sleek looking. It's a bike that came, and again, like the Rune, this bike never got an update, right? Because it was put out as this big sort of, you know, excess thing to buy, even though it came in at a very reasonable price. And then, you know, the market for it disappeared with the 2007 economic crash. And, you know, but they never needed to update it because it was just put out correctly. Because all they did was, you know, put this different engine in the Vulcan, essentially do these styling changes. And really, they just fixed any problem you could ever have with the Kawasaki Vulcan. And they just made it into its, they just evolved it into its final form. and this is the top of the mountain. I mean, I can't think of a better cruiser, you know? And if you want, like, you know, you could get, you know, windshields and stuff for this. You could get accessories that Kawasaki sold, you know, just for it.
This also perfectly ties in to classic Kawasaki Escalation.
Exactly. That was the final point I was going to get to. Kawasaki went, hold on a second. Who are we? What do we do? Right? When everyone else raises the bar, we wait about a year and a half, and then we just unload with displacement. And Kawasaki figured out if we just go to 2 liter, we can do all these things and satisfy all these different needs, and we can make this bike perfect. Rather than trying to make something that towed the line, you know, the Vulcan 1500, 1600, very much were just trying to replicate exactly what the Road King was or is.
I wouldn't be shocked.
And this bike went to just blow it out of the water. And when you think about it, that's something that Japanese bikes in this category rarely do.
I wouldn't be shocked if we could go and talk to one of the designers and find out that there was just some V12 tugboat that they pulled the cylinders out of.
Yeah, this is just two banks of those cylinders, right? Or one bank of the
that they just pulled out and like, well, here you go.
Yeah, this thing. Like I said, it's very much like the Japanese to make a sport bike that crushes. They don't really do that with cruisers.
I can't think of a single bike that has a larger displacement cylinder than this bike. Are these the largest production cylinders in a motorcycle?
I'll bet they are, at over 1 liter each. Yeah.
Well, that's just another point in its favor.
Yeah. Half of this engine is 58 cc's larger than my Superhawk.
Half of this engine is disqualified from superbike racing.
Yeah. There you go. It's absolutely ridiculous. But again, it gets completely forgiven for being ridiculous because it comes in at that price.
Right.
Right? That's the magic of this bike. And, you know, you've got to find one because they didn't sell a huge amount of them. You know, they sold a few, but then the crash came. And, you know, we would see a lot more of these on the road if 2007 didn't happen, right? This was like on the road, like, you know, set to be the next like big selling cruiser, and it almost happened, but then the economic crash came. And
have you noticed how much of bike culture has started to center around World War II and the economic recession in 2008?
Oh yeah, 2007, 2008, yeah, 2007, 2008, and like. The early 40s define everything. It's true in the aviation industry, which again owes everything to World War II. So yeah, this bike could have been what everybody's dad bought, you know, a decade ago, but didn't because of factors we know about.
Because their pensions all disappeared.
Right, but they did make some. And I remember seeing these things in dealerships, and I thought they were still quietly making it, and they just kind of quietly killed it, like by like 2010 or something like that, and weren't selling it. They may have even only made it till 2008. I'm not exactly sure. But they did make these things, and at a certain point just had to start giving them away. So when you find one now, they are absurdly cheap. Absurdly cheap for something that's approaching like VMAX, like top speeds, and certainly has VMAX acceleration. Something that has close to, you know, like ZX6R Ninja 600 acceleration with that torque. Like it's just a beast of a machine. And you get to like ironically do this baby boomer, like classic cruiser cosplay thing. And you get the Japanese reliability, but you get this weird sort of throwback classic American styling. It satisfies everybody. Like, if you hate this motorcycle, I hate you.
I almost wish Dad hadn't chopped up his old chaps to make a motorcycle seat for the two strokes.
Oh, yeah.
Because I would totally cosplay with the chaps on one of these. Bike.
Yeah, right? You know, and I'm not a cruiser guy, but, like, I would own this thing in a heartbeat. Oh, my gosh, I would own one of these. So, yeah, I don't know. You got anything else to add to that?
I think we've said everything we need to say.
All right, there we go. Best bike in the world this week, the Kawasaki Vulcan 2000. Look for them on your local Craigslist. Okay, and we're back. So, we are going to do another installment of our increasingly popular How to Sound Like You Know What You're Talking About series. So, what did we talk about in the last one of these? It was, fuel injection and carburetors, right? Mm-hmm. So, we're going to do sort of a series now on mechanical signatures, right? So, these are things that, by design and mechanics, that certain companies have latched onto and have sort of made a trademark of their brand. And so we're going to be doing these for weeks and weeks because there's a lot of these. I mean, everything from Honda VTEC to Ducati Desmo valves to Buell, the ZTL brake system. There's a bunch of things.
How do you get power out of a pushrod motor?
Well, yeah, but that's going to come tangentially with all the rest of this. What we're talking about is engineering principles that probably weren't designed by these companies, but they have latched onto and just made a part of the ethos of their company. And we're going to start this by talking about engine configurations and engine configurations that have become mechanical signatures of various brands. So I feel like it's kind of fair just to start with Harley-Davidson and why they use a 45-degree V-twin, right? Mm-hmm. Now, this one's fairly straightforward. Well, I guess we should say, up to this point, their mechanical signature has been a 45-degree air-cooled V-twin.
Pushrod.
Exactly.
Well, I guess recently they have the four-valve double overhead cam Milwaukee 8s.
That's true, but still air-cooled and all that sort of stuff. So let's talk about, like, why does Harley use this engine and why is it their thing? And why, you know, do some people dog on it? But it's actually a pretty good thing for them to use, you know, because it's a big company. There's a lot of smart people that work for them. They don't use it because they're idiots, right?
Right.
So they use this motor because a V-twin lends itself very well to having a long stroke and a shorter bore and producing more torque. That's why, because Harley makes heavy bikes, and when you have a V-twin engine configuration, you only have two cylinders. You're putting all that displacement into just only two cylinders. And when the cylinders run long, you know, so they have the piston travels further than it is wide, then the pistons are acting more mechanical advantage onto the crankshaft, and it feels like more power just when you initially crack the throttle. And that more torque and that more mechanical advantage from the piston moving that larger distance is great for moving more weight, because we all know Harley-Davidson's are heavy motorcycles. There is a certain satisfaction from revving an engine, having it produce huge torque and move a big amount of weight. You know, and there's an equal satisfaction to revving an engine high to move a smaller amount of weight, producing less torque, but producing more horsepower to move a light bike fast. But there's something to low revving big torque, right? Think about a Ford pickup truck. They don't produce a huge amount of horsepower. They produce a lot of torque. You still recognize this is a big, powerful engine. even though it doesn't produce as much ultimate power as, you know, some race car or whatever, it produces a lot of torque, which helps you move a lot of weight. And you're not interested in driving the F-150 very fast anyway. Same concept behind a Harley-Davidson. You're moving this bike. It's got a lot of torque. It kind of picks up and goes. And then at a certain point, it just sort of runs out of power. Even though it feels like it's just going to, the power is going to keep going forever. Eventually, you get to the top of that power band. You don't have any more, you're not producing any more horsepower, but you've produced gobs of torque up to there. So you get up to highway speeds on a big, heavy bike just as quickly as you need to. But then all of a sudden, it runs out.
All of a sudden, you reach, you're doing 65 miles an hour. You hit a 5% incline. You twist the throttle more, and there's no more power to be had.
Right.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's the trade-off for having an 800-and-something-pound bike, and, you know, and it's got the engine dimensions that it has, and it needs to be able to pull you and your passenger and all your weight, and needs to do it at highway speeds all day long. That's why the engine has to be what it's going to be. Now, why does Harley still insist on making these engines air-cooled? This is really where the mechanical signature comes in. There is no good answer, really, except that they love the way it looks. It's classic and it's throwback.
Well, also, yeah, Harley always has their motors on display. There is no fairing on any Harley motor. You will always have the V-twin on display.
Right.
So, well, also, the only exception here is the Street 500 and the Street 750.
The motor's still on display, but it's not a but they beautiful actually
have,
motor.
But they have the liquid cooling on it.
Yes.
And the fan. But the other aspect...
And the V-rod.
Yeah. But the main thing here is that the other major advantage of just having an air-cooled motor is it's simply less moving parts.
It's
one less thing to fail.
And I guess we should just say, in case you're not like aware of how it works, it is as simple as it gets, right? The fins on the engine that you see are essentially, I guess, heat sinks, right? The heat from the engine goes out into these bits of metal, which are fins coming off the side. The air comes by it, and then the heat is transferred from those fins to the air. And there's a very distinct limitation to this of, you know, how much air can pull off how much heat and how much heat these fins can take away from the engine. So the amount that the temperature will vary on these engines is much wider than it's going to be on an air-cooled engine, and you can risk overheating in a situation where you have to be in stop-and-go traffic or just at a complete standstill.
When you have what you call an air-cooled motor, which will also be occasionally referred to as an air/oil-cooled motor or just an oil-cooled motor.
That's true, because Harleys do use oil-cooled heads.
Is that what you will have is either just the fins on the cylinders where you have oil running around the outside of the motor and the oil is conducting the heat into the outside casing of the motor, mm-hmm. which goes to the fins and the air goes through it and cools it that way. Or you may have an oil cooler on your bike where the oil circulates through a radiator.
Right.
Or you'll have a liquid-cooled motor where you have a completely separate set of tubing through your motor and out into a radiator where you'll have coolant like every single modern car has.
Right. Even lots of antique cars.
Right. And the real benefit of the liquid-cooled motor is that you can get amazing thermal efficiency because coolant is, even oil at its optimal temperature, cannot be as viscous as coolant.
Right.
It can't even be as viscous as coolant at room temperature. So whereas with your just air-cooled motor, you'll have those giant fins coming off the cylinders that are cooling the motor. With a liquid-cooled motor with coolant in it, you can transfer all that heat to the coolant, and you can pass it through a radiator that may, at a visual glance, have a quarter of the surface area as the motor does, but actually has 20 times the surface area in the fins that all of the coolant is going through.
Right.
And all you're doing with the liquid cooled motor is maximizing the surface area that you can get air cooling over.
Well, also in the liquid cooled motor with the radiator and the fan, you can adjust to some degree the amount that it's cooling the engine. So you can better regulate the temperature of the engine.
Right. Well, and that's another thing is because you
have... In general, there's a lot of leeway here, but in general, you want it to be somewhere around like 230, 250 degrees for optimal temperature. I mean, give or take a lot for different kinds of engines and things, but generally that's the range.
Right, but also when you have that massive surface area, you can do things like add a fan...
That's what I'm saying. The fan will increase the airflow or decrease it, and you can. That's right, how you regulate.
But the fan has so much more effect because it is pulling that air over so much larger of a surface area.
Right.
By putting it behind the radiator.
Exactly.
And then you can have a temperature sensor so that if you're just stuck in traffic, the fan can just be on all the time, so your engine doesn't heat if you're stuck in traffic.
Right. And then you run into weird things. So here's the thing. So if in a Harley, you know, air cooled engine, the cooling is just what the cooling is, right? There's no way for the fan to kick on and adjust that cooling or decrease the amount of cooling that's happening. It's just by the nature of how the bike's riding and the conditions that it's in, the ambient temperature, then your engine temperature is just what it's going to be. And there you go. And that's another reason that Harley engines have to be overbuilt and understressed, because they need to be able to withstand high temperatures if you get into adverse riding conditions. So why does Harley stay with air-cooled? Or why have they until this recent announcement where they're going to do some liquid-cooled bikes? Because they just think those engines look fucking cool. And that's really the only reason.
And
for
everything I have argued for in terms of cool bikes, I'm going to give them that one.
You know,
because it's cool engine, is a valid reason.
Okay, it is. It is to some degree. But, you know, and I have to admit, an air-cooled engine looks great. It's a great look. And it looks so great that you even run into things with things like the Kawasaki Vulcan 15 and 1600. Which have fake air cooling fins on them, essentially.
Right.
You know, even though it's a liquid cooled bike with a huge radiator, they still had to give it this sort of like, you know, because an air cooled V twin motor, because of how successful Harley Davidson is just synonymous with big cruiser bikes. And you can't make a big cruiser bike if it doesn't have fins on the engine. It just doesn't look right. To people these days, anyway. Although the Indian Scout is changing that a little bit. Look at an Indian Scout. Liquid cooled, and I don't know, the engine looks pretty cool, so.
Do you mean a Victory Octane?
Exactly. Yeah, the Indian Scout, better known to us as the Victory Octane. Look it up, people. Or sheeple, should I say. Right? All right, so that's a basic breakdown of Harley and why. Oh, and I want to say the 45 degree angle we should talk about real quick. Harley always insists on saying it's a 45 degree V-twin air-cooled engine. Why? Well, so there are when you make an engine with two cylinders, anywhere from like a single cylinder or a twin cylinder engine where a parallel twin, like an old, like a Bonneville, let's say, where you have two engines right in line, that's basically just operating like two single cylinder engines right next to each other, and their counterbalancers work that way, and they can pretty much balance themselves like very, very well, right? And then when you go to, and then there's two other degrees that are sort of equally unoptimal as far as balancing goes. And those happen to be 45 and 90 degrees. And, well, I guess there's another one, 180 degrees. And Harley goes with 45 degrees because it allows them to do a certain kind of engine timing, which they like. And it also creates pretty much the maximum amount of up and down vibration that the engine creates. And, you know, and that's how it goes. And Harley people, for a long time, just put up with the vibration of the engine. And then it just became part of the bike. And people love the vibration now. And it's part of the, quote, character of the engine.
Which I think I covered pretty well on my review of the Ultra Classic, which was, you don't really notice it while you're riding, while you're in motion. But under 10 miles an hour, it's very noticeable.
Oh, it'll like send your hands numb if you just sit and stop and go traffic.
Right. But it kind of gives you this, it gives you this whole feeling and kind of builds on the overall Harley experience, which is this whole idea of I'm riding this unruly mess and I'm taming it.
I'm such a man that I can handle this piece of equipment. Exactly.
Because it feels like such, it feels like such a chore to just keep it under control while you're sitting still. But when you pull away and all of a sudden you've got it under control and you got both your feet up on the platforms, you feel like the best motorcycle rider in the world because you've tamed the beast.
This is not an aspect of motorcycles I'm really into because it's like kind of largely false. And I know that sounds contrary to what I was talking about with the Honda Beats scooter, right? Where they sort of gave you this step down in technology, but reconfigured it to make you feel more in control. This is just sort of a different thing because in my thing of like, you know, giving a rider a flip button for a fuel mapping or a button to press to change the exhaust to give you extra boost, that's still something you're doing, right? Whereas the Harley sort of thing and making you feel more engaged with the machine is all completely passive. It's just because of, you know, how the machine is, and it's unnecessary on top of it because they could make the bikes a different way in my, you know, the way I see it. They just married themselves to this engine configuration, this mechanical signature. And I mean, I don't hate it, but I don't really see the value in the whole, like, oh, this Harley feels so unruly. I must be such a man for being able to master it.
Yeah, it's not for me either, but I understand why it's there.
I get it. I understand why they do it for their customers as well. But for me, it's just not my cup of tea. But anyway, let's move on because we got a lot of other engines to get to. What should we hit next? I kind of like talking about Japanese inline fours.
Okay, let's go there.
All right. So basically I'm not going to say all time favorite, but it's definitely top three, if not top two, my favorite engine configuration of all time is an across the frame or transverse inline four engine. So this is the engine you see on like every Japanese crotch rocket, for lack of better terms, right? You've got four cylinders, and they don't run straight to the frame. They go across the frame, right? So cylinder one's by your left knee, cylinder four is by your right knee, right? So the advantage to this is basically, what you have is a motorcycle with a miniature version of a Formula One engine. That's kind of where this all came out of. The Japanese realized they could make a very, very lightweight bike, and it wouldn't need very much torque because it was light. But by decreasing the stroke of the engine, so in vast contrast to the Harley V-twin, they could make the bore really wide and the stroke really small, but on top of that, add cylinders. So on a four-stroke motor, right, you only have one compression stroke, one ignition or firing stroke, right, out of four different strokes. But if you got four cylinders, then on every stroke of the engine, every rotation of the crankshaft,
you've got a power stroke.
You've got a power stroke, exactly. And by making the stroke really short, you've got less reciprocating mass and less need to put counterbalancers and extra weight in the engine. So,
right. So
you could you can create these engines that rev ridiculously high. And even though they won't pull as much weight, they will ultimately create a much, much higher, you know, horsepower output than an equivalent or even larger sized, you know, Harley style V-twin engine, which is why crotch rockets are so unbelievably fucking fast.
Right. So the fundamental principle of just adding more cylinders to make a more powerful engine is the concept of a 10-pound rock hitting you at 10 miles an hour is the equivalent of a 1-pound rock hitting you at 100 miles an hour.
Right.
So, you know, those are equivalent things, but the real problem with the standard internal combustion engine that everyone uses is when you have pistons going up and down in a cylinder, that's reciprocating mass, which means to go up and down as opposed to cyclical, like the wheels on your car, every time that piston goes up and goes down, it has to accelerate at the maximum speed that it needs to go.
There's the decelerate.
It then has to slow down and come to a complete stop and then go back down as quick as it can.
Which robs power.
Well, it robs power, and it also threatens exploding and disintegrating into a million pieces.
Right. Every time your pistons are going up and down, they're trying to tear your engine apart.
Right. I mean,
which is why there are counterbalancers, which are just weights swinging in the opposite direction inside your engine.
Right. You can have a, you know, an 80s air-cooled inline four, and you can rev it up to 20,000 RPM if you want to. And it'll probably last about 10 seconds.
Right.
Until it explodes into a million pieces. So how do you make that work? Well, what you do is you make the piston rods as light as you possibly can, and you make them out of the highest quality and have the highest tensile and compressive strength that you can possibly put into that steel. And that's what you make all your parts out of. But you lighten them as much as you can, because what you can do is if you make them travel a shorter distance and put less strain on them, and then you just add more cylinders,
right?
Then you can spread out the work being done by each cylinder.
And it overcomes the addition of extra weight by those cylinders as well.
Right. Now, the problem here is that you're adding a bit more weight and you're reducing the mechanical advantage. So you don't have the immediate torque that a big V-twin has.
So you have to have a 350 to 400 pound sport bike in order to make this work.
Well, if you want to accelerate quickly off the line, you do. But, I mean, the maximum power available, it doesn't matter.
That's
how
true.
Big the bike is. And the practicality is that, well, you may have to spend a little bit more time spinning up this engine and getting the RPMs going,
right,
to take advantage of the extra power. But you do have more overall power available,
right,
than even an engine two or three times larger than it than that.
Right. So why is this a mechanical signature? This is a bit of an oddball one because it's not a mechanical signature per se for any single manufacturer. But what this is a mechanical signature for is what we refer to as the big four: Honda, Suzuki, Yamaha, Kawasaki. So ever since the mid-70s and late 60s for Honda, they've all been making inline four across the frame engines. And they started with air-cooled ones. Some were wet, some were dry. They're all sorts of different things. And now they've all moved into, essentially, they've all sort of...
they've all converged on the core inline four, liquid-cooled, chain-driven, wet sump, wet clutch.
Yep.
Motor.
And it is sort of, as far as racing goes, the be-all and end-all. Now, in MotoGP, there's a move towards V4s and things like that, but still Yamaha and Suzuki does an inline four. Another big advantage of this motor is they don't, you know, in a lot of the old 70s bikes, the cylinders would just sit straight up, you know, like they would in an old British bike, except there were four of them. These days, they angle the engine, and because you've got all four cylinders in a row angled forward, you can get a really, really nice forward weight bias on a bike, which is fantastic when you're trying to make a bike going faster on a track, because a forward weight bias, you're getting that weight towards the front of the bike where the front brake is, and the bike can slow down and handle that much better in a turn. So that's another huge advantage of this engine configuration, which is why the big four do it. And pretty much all the most badass race bikes and, you know, ones that you can buy as a consumer, they're all inline fours. And it's really just the Japanese big four that do it. They've been doing it so long and they're all so good at it that anyone else just trying to jump in and make one that can compete at this point, they're so far behind, they don't even try. And the only, we were racking our brains all afternoon trying to, we were like, there's got to be someone else making a competitive inline four. And all we came up with was the BMW with the S1000 double R. And they used to put some inline fours in the K bikes, but those weren't even race competitive and they weren't pretending to be.
Right.
So just across the board.
Well, they had the K1.
Yeah, right, right. Exactly. Yeah. So that's a mechanical signature for them engine wise. That is pretty unique to those four companies. You know, no one else does it the same way. No one else.
A few others have tried, but the Japanese have got that on lockdown.
Oh, so hard. So let's talk about something now a little bit more open. I want to talk about Triumph and triples. Now, Triumph is by no means the only manufacturer to make three-cylinder engines. I mean, the amount of people that have made three-cylinder engines is ridiculous over time. But in this modern era, Triumph is the only one just sort of running with this thing. And the beauty of a three-cylinder engine is a couple different directions. One, it's ridiculously easy to balance. So, you know, the way the cylinders are going up and down, right? The way you balance the engine out, there's an inherent problem in trying to perfectly balance a four-cylinder engine. It's actually just not possible. But a three-cylinder or a V6, you could, right? So they're inherently very smooth engines when you're riding it. It's a really nice experience because the engine is just, it's just like this power is just magically happening underneath you. You know, it's just, it feels weird and futuristic. Even if you're on an old vintage three-cylinder bike, it's a great right. feeling. The other advantage to it is that it's the perfect marriage of torque and horsepower. You're sacrificing a little bit of torque and you're sacrificing a little bit of horsepower, but ultimately making, you know, pretty good gains in in both. It's weird. You get a little bit of everything, because the three-cylinder engine, let's say, you know, you've got a 750 three-cylinder versus a 750 four-cylinder, right? Well, how are you going to make that work in a three-cylinder motor? You're probably going to do it by making it a longer stroke three-cylinder and increase the displacement that way. Three-cylinders tend to be torquey engines for their displacement. Not as much as two-cylinders, but
a hell of a lot more than
four-cylinders. Right. And also, you know, as opposed to like a V-twin engine or a parallel twin engine, you know, you've got that still that extra cylinder making extra firing strokes for you,
right,
helping you spread out that mass and helping you get a little bit higher RPM. So it's right. It's a sweet spot right in the middle. If you're like, well, I'm not a V-twin cruiser guy, but I'm not like a Rice Rocket guy.
So you can't
the three cylinder engine might be for you.
Right. So you can't really do this in cars, because as you scale up each cylinder in volume, the whole design doesn't scale up, and that's why an inline three feels a lot like a V6 does in a car. The same way that you can't scale up an inline four motor in a car past, you know, maybe 2.5 liters before it starts getting silly.
Mm-hmm.
The inline three is a great design, but it doesn't work in cars until you go up to V6. Because all of the balancing just doesn't scale up past a certain point.
Wait, I will take exception to that. Jeep did a four liter inline straight four engine. That was pretty great, but that was exceptionally low revving. It was the only way that worked.
Well, yes, if you... an inline four motor that isn't moving is exceptionally smooth.
Right. but anyway, sorry, I just had to shit on your point for a second. But like in 99% of all use cases, you're completely correct. So why is Triumph like made this their mechanical signature?
Right? Well, I think it's a perfect move, because you can make something under, you know, outside of the 1 liter category, which, if you're in Europe, is hugely important for insurance purposes.
Yes.
You can make a motor that has good horsepower, and more importantly for the overall rider experience,
butt-kicking torque.
Right. In a small displacement motor.
Right. You could.
It is the most real-world motor for riding a motorcycle on public roads.
In terms of just all out, just ridiculous fun in general. Yeah. And it's great too, because the engine, the problem again with the three cylinder engine as opposed to the four is that, and this is where its actual problem is a strength in the, like on the four cylinder engine, like we said, you know, there's four strokes and only one of those is the power stroke. Well, or firing stroke, whatever you want to call it, whichever part of the world you're from. Well, on the three-cylinder, for every rotation of the crankshaft, one of those firing strokes is then missing. And that gives the exhaust a really distinct sound, and it gives the motor a very distinct feeling. And, you know, when there's enough torque and enough horsepower available anyway, that little bit of disadvantage on the firing order not being perfect and everything like that, it turns into what we call engine character. And it just makes it, you just notice a difference. Even though there's plenty of power and plenty of torque, you notice that it's not perfect. And what that translates to is to like, it just feels unique and therefore more fun.
Which in fairness is exactly what Harley does.
Yes.
With the 45 degree V-twin.
Right. But I'm a bigger fan of Triumph and the three cylinders because there's more performance involved.
Right.
And Triumph even went way far out there with their three cylinder thing with a little bike called the Rocket 3. in order to prove that even as opposed to Harley, their concept could work. So rather than an inline three, they made a bike that was a straight three. And this was a bike that was originally put out, and I want to say 1967. It was a model shared with BSA and Triumph, the Rocket 3. And that was a straight three as well, I believe. Or was it across the frame? I can't remember. Anyway, it doesn't matter. And then Triumph, when they sort of like reinvented the company in the 90s, they were like, we got to make another Rocket 3. And so they made not a transverse across the frame Rocket 3, a straight 3, and decided to outdo Harley Davidson and make it 2.3 liters on three cylinders. Ridiculous. And it is to this day the largest displacement engine ever put in a production motorcycle. And recently I was watching a video of Shade Tree Surgeon, who has a fantastic YouTube channel, by the way. If you haven't seen it, watch Shade Tree Surgeon. He comes off pretty rough, but has a lot of great thoughts. I'm a big fan of him. Anyway, he described his Rocket 3 as when you pull the throttle, it only works well in a straight line. But when you pull the throttle, it just goes like a raped ape. It just goes, because it doesn't even make huge horsepower because it's so large. They can't get the engine to rev that high, but just ridiculous, untold amounts of torque. And it just accelerates like nobody's business. And if you've ever seen a modern Triumph Rocket 3 in person, it almost makes a Goldwing look small. It is huge.
It is cartoonish.
The tank alone, I think it has a 6.5 gallon tank. Like, it's ridiculous.
It has to.
Yeah, because the bike goes through so much fuel. I mean, this is a bike that probably only gets about 28 miles per gallon. But it's okay because you've got a 2.3 liter three-cylinder imported motorcycle, right? Like, you're already real weird and fetishist by the point that you even looked at one, right? Or even knew what one was.
I think the only time I saw one was down at Steele's, and I just immediately ran across the building. It's like, Peter, they have a Rocket 3.
Yeah, and my dick got hard.
It's like, yeah, it's not for sale. It's a customer. It's here for service. It's like, oh man.
Yeah, a stupid motorcycle. Oh, I love stupid motorcycles.
Why are you blue-balling us by putting it out on the floor then? Jesus Christ.
I know. All right, so what other so there you go. So Triumph, again, and a lot of different companies have made three-cylinder motorcycles, but Triumph with their Daytona, with the Street Triple, with the Rocket 3, they've really made three-cylinder bikes their thing. Now, Yamaha does a three-cylinder with the MT-09, but it's not like a Yamaha thing, you know? And who else is making a three-cylinder? It's a short list. I know we're forgetting people, but the point is it's a short list. It's sort of Triumph's mechanical signature, and it's their, like, what they're best known for and what they're doing well. So, who do we want to talk about now? Let's talk about Ducati and the L-Twin.
Well, actually, let's go across and do Moto Guzzi. Because okay. Moto Guzzi has done something that is by far the most consistent and are the most strict on their characteristic, which is a 45 degree.
I thought it was 65. Is it 45?
It's a 45.
Okay.
Transverse.
Yeah.
V-twin shaft drive.
So the shaft drive is sort of important here, but it's less important to me than the fact that they do a transverse V-twin. So I don't know. If you're into bikes, you've been in a used dealership and there's been a Moto Guzzi in there at some point, and you heard someone or saw someone walk by this bike and go, "What's a Moto Guzzi?" And someone goes, "It's a Moto Guzzi." And then they look at it and they go, "Why is the engine in there sideways?" And so they do. So Moto Guzzi has only ever made a V-twin air-cooled motorcycle like Harley Davidson, but rather than put their engine in line with the frame, they turn it transverse. So the cylinders stick out to either side of the bike.
Now there's there's a very good reason for why they stick to this setup.
Because it's beneficial for their transmission.
Well, there's two things. One is, if you turn the engine sideways, you've got more airflow over an air-cooled motor.
That's true. Even cooling.
And then with having the shaft drive, the worst thing you can possibly do to a shaft drive is make it go through more turns.
Right.
So, for instance,
every bevel on that turn in the shaft drive system robs more and more power to the back wheel.
So, yeah. Well, it's not every bevel, but every time you make the shaft turn 90 degrees.
Which would be by device of a bevel drive.
Yeah, but it's like...
I know what you're saying. We're in violent agreement. Right. I know what you're saying.
It's sort of like how, you know, the KZ 750 and the CB900 and the CB1000... Having an inline four
shaft drive system is dumb.
Is ridiculous because it has to do another 90 degree turn.
Right, because the bike might make 100 horsepower, but rather than 80 something horsepower that should get to the back
70 wheel, or 65 is getting there.
Like 59. It's terrible.
This gets absolutely getting robbed.
Every time you make your drive system turn 90 degrees in order to get to the back wheel, you're losing a 30% of power.
Whereas when you've got a crankshaft turning perpendicular to the frame, and you've just got a chain going from that crankshaft back to the rear wheel,
then you've just got the 10% of the chain losing power, right?
As opposed to the 25 or 30% if you go through this ridiculous route.
Right.
So the advantage is you can have an air-cooled motor, you can simplify and drop the number of parts and the number of fluids and the amount of maintenance, and you can get maximum airflow for cooling over this motor, and then you can have a straight line and a single 90-degree turn on a drive shaft to the rear wheel. And on top of that, you can get some reasonable power from an air-cooled V-twin motor with the smallest number of parts and have the absolute minimum amount of maintenance with the most reliability you can possibly get.
Right.
And I can't think of... Oh, I certainly can't think of a single Moto Guzzi that has not followed this pattern.
Absolutely dogmatic. There's no deviation. I mean, you would see the Pope endorse Marilyn Manson before Moto Guzzi deviated from this setup. There is no way they'll ever do anything else. And you know what? It's a setup that does work. Now, is it the best? Here's the weird thing about Moto Guzzi, though. Is it the best setup for any particular kind of riding?
No.
But it does mean that every Moto Guzzi is sort of de facto a great all-rounder kind of bike.
Right. Yeah, I mean, there's the thing about it is that if you have a Moto Guzzi and you take care of it, and if you have the part support,
and it's not August,
then it'll last forever.
Yeah.
You take care of it well, then it's going to break down the least, and it's going to be wonderful, and you'll love it, and you can ride it forever.
But there are quirks that come along with it.
There are some quirks in the business model.
So this is a natural,
but not in the engineering.
This is a natural transition then into BMW and the flat twin. Because the flat twin, so again, you've all seen a picture of a BMW. You know, just look up a picture of a, you know, Google long way round, like whatever, right? So the two cylinders are sticking straight out from either side, right? Now, the reason that BMW does this is why they did it from the inception of BMW in like the 1913 or whenever it was that they started. It was somewhere around there.
Have you noticed with all the old manufacturers, everyone had like a single principle and then just ran with it for 100 years?
Yeah. Yeah. And so BMW was always shaft drive. Always shaft drive. And they've only just deviated from that with their inline four bike, the S1000RR.
Which is their only example.
Which is also, again, their example of an inline four as well. That's a really weirdo bike for BMW. So, well, actually, didn't the K1200 RS was also inline four and chain drive? I could be wrong there, but I think the K1200 RS was as well. But anyway, so BMW is very much the setup that Moto Guzzi has, except for those 45-degree cylinders. They just sit flat. They come out just straight in one side and the other. People call that a boxer engine because, you know, the cylinders are kind of going up and down. It's as if like two, you know, if you take your two fists in front of you and just move them towards as if they're punching each other, that's how the cylinders are moving, right? So they call that a boxer engine.
Yeah. So you have one power stroke from both cylinders at the same time.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah. Right. Also, the advantage to this is like a single cylinder engine, you can balance this engine really, really well.
Well, yeah, because they're always canceling each other out.
Exactly.
This is, yeah, it's perfect reciprocal motion. So you can always balance out the forces on this motor.
So, yeah, if you take a Moto Guzzi at a stoplight and you just rev the engine for no reason, it like pulls to one side, right? BMWs,
which is super fun.
Yeah, I love it. BMWs don't necessarily do this. I think there are BMWs that do various different kinds of engine timing. So some of them will pull to one side and some don't. But in the early ones, I think they just went towards the center, they punch outwards. So the whole boxer analogy is a little bit weird because they do punch outwards rather than together. But that is the motion the cylinders make. But the point is that like Moto Guzzi, because of the way the engine is put and the crankshaft, rather than facing out to the side, goes straight back, it's ideal for a shaft drive setup, which they've always used. People think because like cars use shaft drive that it's a more advanced modern system. It's been around forever. And there are motorcycles that have been using shaft drive since, you know, 1905.
The only reason that cars use shaft drive and not chains is one, because nobody wants to pay for a chain that will handle it. And also, nobody wants to climb underneath their car
and lube
every
their chain
300 miles and lube their chain. Nobody who is commuting 40 miles a day during the work week wants to get up on a Saturday and go wipe their car, their car up and wipe the chain down with kerosene.
Well, also an enclosed chain system for a car that would automatically lube it would just take up an unreasonable amount of space. Like it would just, you would have to give up a seat in the back of your car for like the weird space that this chain was taking up. It's dumb.
But also, if you look at the advances we've made in automotive technology and how much more power we can get out of a motor these days for the same displacement, you may look at something like the 1200 Norge GT.
Yeah.
And say, you know, if I don't have to do any chain maintenance and I've got a computer that tells me everything's all good, I'm cool with not having to lube a chain for this amount of power.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's good. No, there definitely are places in this world where a shaft drive motorcycle makes more sense than a chain drive.
Well, here's the thing. Especially if you think about when we go down to COTA, if you're going to do an iron butt, do you want to have to lube your chain three times to do a 1,000-mile motorcycle trip?
Well, this is why I just bought a Scott Oiler.
Right.
You know, like it is a pain in the ass. I've gotten to that point in my life where I am tired of doing that, so I just got a Scott Oiler, and now my chain problems are done.
Right. Well, you will run into the same problem I have on the W6.
I know the back wheel gets dirty and everything, but like I wash the bike enough, I can spray that off. It's not a huge problem for me.
You can't do it enough. It's always there. This is something you have to learn to live with.
Well, okay. But anyway.
But that is the wonders of a shaft drive. It's just, it does rob a lot of power, but if your bike can produce more power than you could possibly ever use on the road responsibly, then
it doesn't matter.
Yeah. Then it's a blessing that it just takes away that chore.
All right. Can we think of another? Okay. Here's one. Shit. I was going to say, but it's not brand specific. But have we got another brand specific for motorcycle? Oh, no. We haven't talked about the Ducati L-Twin yet. Okay, this is the last one for today anyway. So Ducati married themselves to what's called an L-twin engine. Now, in essence, this is really not very different than a V-twin engine, except that rather than making a V-shape, it makes an L-shape because it's a 90-degree angle on the crankshaft, right? So traditionally, the way that Ducati does this is one cylinder sticks almost straight up in the air, but just a little bit backwards, and one sticks almost straight just forwards towards the front wheel, but just a little bit up. And they do this for some interesting reasons. So the cylinders, the way that the engine can be balanced at when the cylinders are opposed that way on the crankshaft, it produces basically just as much as vibration as a 45-degree V-twin does. But rather than that vibration going up and down like it does on a V-twin, it goes forwards and backwards, which is a little less noticeable for the person riding the bike. But what it allows Ducati to do is play around with the engine weight, right? So the bikes get what's called a rear weight bias. So you get one cylinder with all of its weight really low down, and the rest of the weight biased more towards the back of the bike than the front of the bike, which changes the handling and the dynamics. And the way that the two-cylinder engines put down huge torque and everything, front-end feel and everything traditionally just becomes, in that configuration, less important. It's all about focusing everything about the back of the bike and how it puts down power hard at the back. And that's just the whole philosophy of the motorcycle. It's in stark contrast to the way the Japanese make their inline four motors with the front weight bias, the braking, the higher horsepower. The Ducatis go for bigger torque, less overall horsepower, rear weight bias. And traditionally, you know, Ducatis just tend to be wheelie monsters because of all of that as well. And that's why they do that.
And nobody complained.
Nobody complained. Nobody complained because the bikes are ridiculously fun to ride in the real world. Yeah, they're finicky. They're Ducatis. They need a lot of service. They have their weird Desmo system, which we'll go in a much different episode later on, and all of that. But the reason that they do that L-twin is for weight biasing towards the bottom and the back of the bike versus high into the front of the bike like the Japanese do. and for the big torque, like a V-twin configuration, because an L-twin's really just a V-twin. And it's just, you know, an optimal system for them in the way that they configure their tanks and the rest of their frame, the trellis frame, all of that ties into it. It's all beneficial for them. It's for something a little bit more Buell-like in terms of performance, but has been refined over a much longer time period, and it's just the way they are. Now, Ducati is moving towards their new V4 Panigale. I'm not saying moving towards, they have it out. What am I talking about? But I think that's just sort of a bit of a fad. And I think Ducati is always going to make L-twin engines for
Oh, they're for not going to stop market. Making yeah. L-twins just because they're making the V4 Panigale.
But I think even the V4 Panigale is going to be a little short-lived. I would say that the V4 Panigale is more likely to go inline 4 than it is to stay a V4.
No.
Yeah.
No, I we have never gone this hard.
The V4 Panigale is not going to be long on this world. There are not enough advantages to that engine for what they're trying to do.
You mean like winning World Superbike?
See, I don't think it's going to happen. I don't think it's going to happen.
Oh, it's going to happen. Well, first of all, they're going to get rid of their bullshit single-sided swing arm.
And that's another mechanical signature we're going to talk about in a later episode.
No, they are going to redo the 1199 Panigale that they're running in World Superbike. They're going to make a proper V4 and crush World Superbike. It's going to take a while. It's going to take a few years. It's going to take a couple
of years. If they win World Superbike, then the V4 Panigale will stick around. But if they don't win it within 2 years... they're going to either go back to just a regular V-twin with getting, you know, 1,200 cc's versus the 1,000.
Well, they're going to go back to buying out stadium sections and Ducati Island.
Well, they'll never get rid of Ducati Island. You always have to do Ducati Island.
Oh, Ducati Island sucked last year.
Ducati Island did suck last year, but... anyway, point is, if they don't win it in 2 years, the V4 is going away, and I see them doing something really fucking weird, like an inline 4, for that just that no, one premium model.
I refuse to believe this.
The reality is most people, even though the V4 Panigale is out now, everyone just still rides a V-twin Ducati of some description, whether it's a scrambler, whether it's just the regular SS, or whatever it is, you know, the V4 is just this one. It's the V4 Panigale is their, you know, Kawasaki H2R. It's not really that representative of the brand.
But it is a naturally aspirated four-stroke that is within Superbike spec.
Right. But like I said, if it doesn't win right away, they'll abandon it really quick. Because it's a big deal for Ducati to variate from their classic L-twin design, you know, just for these purposes. It's a really big deal. There are purists that hate it.
Well, that's true. But if it doesn't work out, they've only got two other options.
Okay.
One is that they're going to have to go back to the V-twins and fight against the rules and negotiate to get a larger displacement for World Superbike. The second is that they're going to have to start cheating.
Well, they're really good at that. I think that is much more likely.
Those are only two outs. But I think they want the V4 to work.
We may or may not be using the Desmos system or pneumatic valves. Like, we might have as much gas on this bike as we're telling you. And this bike might weigh what we're telling you it weighs. Like, this, you know. How many spark plugs did we tell you were in it? What, 16? No, it was 8. No, yeah, 8, 16, who knows? Yeah, Ducati loves to cheat. I love that they love to cheat as well. But, yeah. What's in the salad box? Is it a gyroscope? I don't know. It's wonderful. So, all right. I think that covers a lot of the basic engine types and why they are mechanical signatures for these makes is basically what we're getting to.
We've got a few other like oddball ones that we can go into, but I think we can put that off too.
Yeah, we can include in that Lady Wars. And I think we're going to do, maybe not every week, but an ongoing series of in how to sound like you know what you're talking about, mechanical signatures for various makes and models of bikes, and really just prefer by brand of bikes, you know, like I said, like Honda and their VTEC, Ducati and the Desmo valves. You know, there's we could do a whole episode on just mechanical signatures from Buell, right? So I don't know if you like it, if you don't like it, let us know. But I think we're at a pretty decent amount of time. And I had some other things to bring up in this episode, but we do not nearly have enough time for that at this point. Okay, so every time you do a different kind of engine on a bike, there's a trade-off. And none of them are necessarily better than others. They're all for different things. And hopefully this was insightful for you on why companies do different kinds of engines and different kinds of motorcycles, right? You know, sometimes we'll trash on a company for, you know, using a certain kind of engine or a certain kind of design, but for the most part, they're very smart people that decide what kinds of engines should go into what kinds of bikes. But, you know, occasionally you get a manufacturer just so latched onto their mechanical signature, they try to make a bike with that engine for no good reason, right? You know, try to get into a different kind of category of bike. So hopefully this, you know, sort of illuminates a lot of that for you. But that being said, it's time to wrap this episode up, I think. So we're going to remind you that you should always leave us 5-star reviews on whatever your listening method of choice is. You should send us an email along with your review if you want to be perhaps a guest star and do best worst bike in the world with us. And, you know, I think the last one with Brian worked out pretty well, despite the fact that there were some recording issues.
Or even if you're just a new rider and you want to come on the podcast, I think it worked out really well, and we love to engage in that experience and share that experience with you.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, new riders to us are just as interesting as people who have been riding for decades. And, yeah. So, with that, you know, send the emails to nokomotopodcast@gmail.com, and we'll remind you to stay safe and stay tuned. And with that, let's run the outro.
And I don't want to die, just want to ride on my